Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. May the 4th be with you, as they say every year on this day. Today, we'll talk to Congressman Gerald Nadler in just a minute. The Senate decided to convene in person today. The House was going to as well, but then Speaker Pelosi decided on second thought, maybe not. Congressman Gerald Nadler on that and much more in just a minute. Also today, we will look at how two kinds of institutions are struggling with how to reinvent themselves to reopen in person eventually, restaurants and college campuses. And also this morning, we will invite you in about an hour to pay one-minute tribute to loved ones you have lost in this coronavirus era so that we keep putting a human face on all these statistics we hear and we give all the time. And as part of that, we'll invite you to talk about grieving while social distancing with a Columbia University grief expert who will be with us for that segment. That's all coming up. Over the weekend, Governor Cuomo released new numbers that indicate the pervasiveness and disparate impact of coronavirus in New York as new cases of the virus continue to be stubbornly high, even if lower than before, even if the weather outside this weekend felt unthreatening. These particular numbers are for positive antibody tests in New York City. That is, the percentage of people who have been exposed to and are now recovered from, presumably, the virus. They're really high in this pretty random sample. Overall, 20% of the antibody tests were positive. So if the sample is accurate, it indicates that 20% or one out of every five people in New York City has already had the virus. Many don't even know it. Many more people will still get sick, no doubt. The disparities, as revealed in this sample, are defined by the Latino or Latinx population and the Bronx. The Bronx had the highest rate of positive tests, not even close. 28% of those people sampled. That's so much higher than all the other boroughs, which were all bunched up around 10 points lower. Brooklyn and Staten Island, 19%, Queens, 18%, and Manhattan, 17%. But again, the Bronx, 28% positive antibody tests. And similarly to the Bronx, Latinx people were in their own category of being hard hit, 25%. Followed by blacks, 17%, Asians at 11%, and whites at 7%. So at the extremes, 25% of Latinx New Yorkers, just 7% of whites in New York City are getting the virus if the sample by the state is accurate. Some of the numbers to know today. The governor is also ordering hospitals to seek more specific demographic information on each new hospitalized patient, because the infection rates remain too high and they want to get it as precise as they can to fight it as precisely as they can. But this is not over by a long shot. With us now, Manhattan and Brooklyn Congressman Gerald Nadler, chairman of the House Judiciary Committee. Among reasons he is in the news, Congressman Nadler released a letter to Amazon chairman Jeff Bezos on Friday saying he expects Bezos to testify about antitrust suspicions because Amazon allegedly used data from third-party vendors who are allowed to sell their stuff on Amazon. Well, Amazon allegedly used that data from the other vendors that they were privy to develop competing products. How about that? On that and more, Congressman Nadler, always good of you to come on. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning.
Would you tell us more about why you wrote to Jeff Bezos first and what your committee can do about it?
Well, sure. We've been conducting a several months long, we've been doing this for quite a while now, investigation of large tech companies and antitrust laws. You know, we haven't passed new antitrust laws in almost 50 years. and we wanted to update them. And I think there's been a failure to enforce antitrust generally, and there's a lot more business concentration than there used to be, and that sort of leads to all sorts of unfortunate results in society at large. And so we've been having this investigation for several months into the large tech companies and antitrust matters. And one of the questions we were looking at is precisely the one you just mentioned, and namely Amazon, which both is the platform through which third-party sellers sell things and almost have to, and by the same token, they then put up products to compete with those third-party sellers. And are they using information they gather as a result of being the platform through which you sell your product to make a competing product to compete with you? And we had asked a witness for Amazon, and he denied that. The Wall Street Journal came out with an investigative article about a week ago, I think, or a week and a half ago, specifically pointing out instances where they were doing this. And that seemed to indicate that the testimony we had gotten from the Amazon representative was not accurate. Huh. So for that reason, we said we wanted to hear from Bezos himself specifically on this question of third-party, of unfair competition with third-party sellers, and on the truthfulness of the companies denying it in light of the Wall Street Journal investigation.
And would that be against the law or just dirty pool in the marketplace?
Well, that depends on exactly how they're doing it. And, of course, we're not conducting a criminal investigation, so we're not talking about whether it's against the law, but maybe whether it ought to be against the law. That's Congress's job, is to pass laws. And we're looking into the whole question of antitrust and are our antitrust laws adequate. That's the whole point of it.
President Trump is always trying to hurt Jeff Bezos, as you know, because Trump wants to hurt the Washington Post, which Bezos also owns and which scrutinizes Trump. Do you fear at all playing into Trump's game of discrediting journalism by being tough on Bezos about this at this time?
No. First of all, we're not aiming at Bezos. We're looking at the competitive or anti-competitive behavior of Amazon.
But you're calling him to testify. That'll be a big deal.
We're calling him to testify as the CEO of Amazon, and because there is a real question here, and we have to get to the bottom of that, and we have to see what kind of behavior they're doing and whether that ought to be against the law, and is it against the law, and should the laws be changed and made more specific.
Trump also wants the Postal Service, with its financial problems, to charge Amazon four times its current rates for shipping packages. We did a segment on Friday about the troubles of the USPS, which have so many implications both for this delivery-intensive era and possibly for voting in November.
Yes.
And that would those extra charges to Amazon presumably would be passed on to consumers buying all those stay-at-home items as another wrinkle.
Well, that's
do you have an opinion on that, or how else to rescue the post office?
Well, first of all, yeah, the post office must be rescued. And the president, Trump, in talking about increasing package rates for the post office, shows his normal ignorance and his normal malevolence against someone he perceives as a political opponent. The post office should certainly not increase its package charges. It would lose much of its business to FedEx and UPS. That would hurt the finances of the post office. It would hurt the general economy. But second of all, the post office is in terrible shape for several reasons, one of which is that Congress, the Republicans, when they controlled Congress a few years ago, required the post office to pre-fund pensions for 75 years. No other company or institution in the United States has that requirement. If that requirement were repealed, which it should be, so that the post office had the normal responsibilities of funding pensions like any state or city government, then they'd be in much better shape, number one. Number two, because of the fall off in mail generally, because of the coronavirus and business, the post office, like every other institution, is suffering. The post office must be bailed out, like a lot of other institutions, by getting a large infusion of money from the federal government, especially given the fact that we're going to need the post office to do a lot more voting by mail, which, assuming the pandemic is still going in November, which is a pretty good bet that it will be, We're going to have to do a lot of the voting by mail, and we have to start preparing for that now. And that's why I certainly hope that the next bill that Congress does on the coronavirus, on all of what we're doing, includes a large infusion of cash for the post office.
My guest is New York City Congressman Gerald Nadler. We can take phone calls for him on anything relevant to him at 646-435-7280. Certainly coronavirus policy and services related questions that pertain to the federal level, 646-435-7280, or things we've talked about so far, like Amazon, 646-435-7280, if you have a question for Congressman Nadler today. Congressman, I see the Senate is reconvening in person today, but not the House. It was going to, then Speaker Pelosi pulled back that plan. Can you say how come and if you support that?
Yes, well, the Senate is only reconvening because of Mitch McConnell's obsession with confirming as many right-wing judges as possible, as quickly as possible, which is not essential to be done. The House is not reconvening because the attending physician, after the Speaker announced that we were going to reconvene, the attending physician objected and said it was not safe to do so yet. It's not safe for staff members. You know, the House is 435 members. It's 4.5 times as large as the Senate, basically. It has a huge staff, and the staff is not just people you think of as staff, it was congressional people, but building workers, cafeteria workers, all kinds of people. And it's not, the contending physician said it's just not safe to do yet. But the fact is, to get together, but the fact is Congress is working. The House is working while not in formal session. We are developing the legislation to deal with the coronavirus, to deal with the economy. We're negotiating. We're doing much of this by phone, by Zoom conferences, et cetera. And as you see, we've passed in the last month, we passed, three major pieces of legislation, and we'll probably have, I hope, the fourth one in the next week or so. So we are working. We're functioning. We're having hearings. We just had a forum on antitrust, as we mentioned. So we are functioning. We're not functioning as efficiently as if we could get together, but we are functioning, and we're doing the public's business.
I saw one report, this was on Politico, citing two sources who say the Capitol physician says there aren't enough tests to proactively test every senator and staffer as they return today. And I also saw separately that both McConnell and Pelosi reject universal testing for members anyway. Do you know why that is? Can you explain that?
Well, there isn't enough of the instant testing that gives you a result right away. And that is true. And I think the Speaker and the Majority Leader felt that it's more important that this testing be used for essential workers, for medical people, and so forth, than for House and Senate members and staff, until we get sufficient testing supplies.
I want to play you a clip of Mayor Bill de Blasio on this show on Friday, making what sounds like an urgent appeal for you and your colleagues' help.
We have been hemorrhaging money in this crisis, and the whole ballgame of what the city is going to look like going forward is going to be decided in a matter of days in Washington, and I'm going to be sounding the alarm here. You know, the House of Representatives right now is drawing up the stimulus bill. If that bill focuses on where the impact of COVID-19 was greatest, and if it's a bill that's based on the justice of serving communities that were hurt the most, then New York City can be made whole and we can move forward. If that bill creates a formula that does not focus on the needs of cities and localities as well as states in terms of what COVID-19 did to them, then we're going to be talking about huge budget cuts. So the pressure needs to be on everyone in Washington. They're responsible now. They're going to help New York City back on our feet or they're not.
Mayor de Blasio here on Friday. So Congressman Nadler, do you have your own take on implications for your Brooklyn and Manhattan district?
Yes, and for the city as a whole, basically. The mayor is entirely correct. The city and the surrounding area, but the city especially, has been the epicenter of the coronavirus in the country. We are far more impacted than most other areas. If you had, and we need a lot of help, what has happened, we've had a shutdown much of the economy, as you know. And what happens in any such a situation is that tax revenues plummet. Sales taxes, no one's buying anything. Income taxes, we have huge unemployment, so we're not collecting income taxes. So that creates, despite the best efforts of the city and the state, a tremendous budget deficits. Now, the city and the state both have the requirement under the Constitution, under the state Constitution for balanced budget, which means there would have to be mammoth service cuts. Mammoth service cuts, which Senator McConnell thinks to think are a good idea, means laying off your fire people and your police officers and your nurses and your doctors and all the essential personnel. And that's ridiculous. The only government that has the ability to fund these things is the federal government. So we must have massive federal aid to offset the loss of revenues caused by the pandemic. And the mayor is entirely right. It's not evenly, that burden is not evenly spread because we are the epicenter, so we have it much worse. And therefore, the formula by which the money that we will appropriate, and we will appropriate money, we're going to have another bill probably in a week or so, and hopefully we'll have a lot of money for state and local governments in that, but the formula to appropriate that money has got to take into account not just the normal things like population and so forth, but the caseload. Where has the impact been? You have a much larger impact in New York because of a much larger caseload. You have a much greater loss of revenue in New York because of a much larger caseload. And the formulas in the legislation that we are developing must take that into account. And based on negotiations in which I've been participating in the last several days, the House bill that we will advance will take that into account and will do very well for areas that are really hit by the virus, like New York City. We will do very well in the House bill. The Senate bill, I'm sure Senator Schumer, who's been involved in these negotiations too, he and the Democrats will push very hard for that. We'll have to see what we can get through the Senate, which is, of course, Republican-controlled. Senator McConnell has said that he thinks that states should go bankrupt, which is not legal, by the way. But that's absurd, because that would destroy the economy of the country, as well as the ability of people to react to the virus and all the first responders.
Let's take a phone call on this. Steve in Levittown on Long Island.
No, let me just add also,
go ahead,
that we have to account for something else, not just the government cost. We have tremendous cultural institutions in New York on which our economy ultimately depends. The museums and the theaters and the libraries and the performing arts centers. They have the same problems because no one's going to them because of the lockdown. They are hemorrhaging revenue, and we have to help them, too, so that when we come out of this, we don't come out of it without our theaters and our museums and our libraries, which is a major factor in the economy, but also a major factor in civilization.
Do you think Congress needs to include those institutions specifically in a bill, as opposed to just helping the states and the cities, and New York City or New York State could decide if to give money or how much money to give to cultural institutions?
I've seen that
critics, I'll give you the pushback and you can respond to the whole thing. Critics are saying that when people are fighting food shortages and depression level unemployment and the government is going trillions into debt, to give tax dollars to art museums and concert halls may be misplaced. So talk about that pushback.
I don't think that is misplaced. I think we do have to give money to private cultural institutions. And I'm not concerned, frankly, about borrowing money by the trillions. We can borrow money right now. The federal government can borrow money at practically negative interest rates. And the federal government, as Paul Krugman has said, a government such as the federal government of the United States or the government of Japan or the government of Great Britain, which denominates debt in its own currency and has a reserve currency, we can borrow almost limitless amounts of money right now at very low interest rates, and you pay it back later when economic growth resumes. And that's how we financed World War II, and there was no problem paying it back, and we have ample opportunity to do that. Great Britain came out of World War II with a debt of 270% of GDP, the United States 145% of GDP. We're at about 70% now. We can have much larger debt and grow our way out of it, but the important thing is to come out of this crisis with our cultural institutions whole, our government institutions whole, our people whole. And that will take money from the federal government, and we should not stint on it.
Steve in Levittown. You're on WNYC with Gerald Adler. Hi, Steve.
Hi. Listen, you guys are awesome. Both of you are some of my favorite people that I don't know. Question is, if we run into the same thing that's been going on for generations, for many, many years, about the problem of getting money actually out of the government for this region in the times of emergency, what comes to mind recently for probably everybody knows about what happened with Sandy. There are still people displaced. What's going to happen when they continue this, you know, pattern? And we have trouble getting what we need. The people that really need it, like you said already. I'll take
bias against this region is what he's bringing up. And Congressman, I remember after 9/11, you and I may have even talked about this, when the federal government started allocating a lot more anti-terrorism money, it did not go proportionally to New York. It went insanely disproportionately to places that were not considered prime targets. And you and your colleagues had a fight to get New York proportionally represented on anti-terrorism money after 9/11. It seems to me here we are in exactly the same position with this. My question out of Steve's comment is, how do you work with Mitch McConnell on this to get to yes, besides just denouncing him?
Well, getting New York its fair share economically and in terms of its need is always a question. There is a prejudice against New York and other parts of the Northeast. You don't have to go back to 9/11. Look at Superstorm Sandy. When people like Cruz and Cornyn and others, and a lot of people, the Republicans at that time, opposed aid to this region for Superstorm Sandy. And a couple of years later, and we had to bludgeon it through. It took quite a while. And a few years later, when there was a major hurricane damage in Texas, they just turned around on a dime and demanded federal aid. That's always a problem. But I think the problem we have now with the coronavirus is much less. I mean, New York is the epicenter. We're hit worse than anybody else, but other areas are hit too and are being hit increasingly. So it's not the way it was with 9/11 or Superstorm Sandy. It was just our region. And McConnell has already had to back down from opposing aid to state and local governments and saying let the states go bankrupt because of the fact that the states like Texas and Florida, red states, are also being hard hit. And in fact, they're being hit increasingly because the pandemic is moving there too. So we'll have allies in Congress, and I do think we'll prevail.
Sarah in Lower Manhattan, you're on WNYC with your congressman, I presume, Gerald Nadler, who does represent the World Trade Center area and other parts of Lower Manhattan. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Good morning, Congressman. I am indeed in your district. I have just today received my PPP money. I've gotten $55,000 for my very small business. I have a pet business and 10 employees. I laid them all off when I had to close under the governor's mandate, and most of them are receiving unemployment. So, and I'm going to hire them all back. They were more furloughed than anything else. Now, my question is, I'm at a complete loss as to how I can keep my business going with the money that I've received because I won't be able to access it or use it until I can reopen. And I've got an 8-week window in which to use these funds, and it's impossible. I won't be able to open in Lower Manhattan in the next 8 weeks. So I know there's a public comment period for the PPP legislation through May 15th, and I definitely intend to write this query as well, but I'm wondering if this is being discussed, the extension of this 8-week period to use these funds to keep small businesses going.
Well, a number of things are being discussed. Number one, the amount of funding has been grossly inadequate. We're going to have to add to that, which I hope we'll do in the next bill. I'm assuming we're going to pass a bill in the next couple of weeks. So we're looking to increase funding. And yes, there is extensive discussion going on some of the problems with the PPP program. The PPP program was intended to benefit small businesses. Of course, one of the problems when Congress appropriates money is that the administration has to carry it out. The administration here is the Trump administration. and they put out regulations and they work through the big banks so that a lot of the money went where it wasn't intended to go, namely to big businesses instead of to small businesses.
Right. But to her question, I think she's asking, would the answer to her question be, if she's asking how can she use the money within the 8 weeks, which is required, if the business isn't reopening, isn't it so that she can pay her employees even if they're not reopening for this period of time?
I'm not sure. The idea of the legislation was that it's a low-interest loan, but if you don't lay off your employees, if you keep them on, it becomes forgiven entirely. And I'm not sure about the 8 weeks, but if that is a problem, we should be dealing with it in the next bill that's coming up.
Sarah,
and I know that there's extensive discussions of the problems that have come up in terms of implementing the PPP.
Right. But do they have to be open in order to pass that loan money on to the employees, or is it supposed to be like another tranche of unemployment insurance, in effect, but funneled through the employers who are closed?
I think it was the former. We provided separately in the legislation for $600 a week unemployment insurance in addition to whatever you got through the states. This was intended to be separate from that.
Trey in the Bronx, you're on WNYC with Congressman Nadler. Hi, Trey.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you so much for taking my call. I work as a, it doesn't even matter. One of my jobs, I work in a warehouse with FedEx. And I'm going to tell you, us warehouse workers have gotten hit really hard. Now, we're not civil servants. We don't take an oath, but we've all had to come into work during this pandemic every day. And I've watched my coworkers get ill, get affected, get forced to stay home. But when we want to stay home, we can't. And I put that to say as if I was nervous and I said, look, I don't want to do this anymore. Right there, I don't qualify for unemployment because in essence, I'm quitting. So all us warehouse workers have been stuck in this catch-22 where we are pretty much disposable. That's how we feel. We're being forced to come in and do our jobs every day under very stressful conditions. And I just want to know, is there anything that's going to be done for us little people who have had to go through this? Because we're not, like I said, we're not healthcare workers. We're not police. We're not firemen. But every day we've been out here, we're pretty much putting our bodies on the line and our families on the line. And except for a little applause I hear on the radio, I mean, I just want to know if we're going to get any kind of support whatsoever. And I'll take any answers offline, and I appreciate you, sir. Thank you.
Trey, thank you very much. And I think, Congressman, that more and more people are going to be in that position as more and more businesses start to reopen around the country, and some of the employees do not feel safe going back to work. But if they voluntarily decline to go back to work, then they may lose their unemployment benefits in exactly the way that Trey is describing.
Well, I'm glad he raised that. I think that is, as he mentions it, I think that is a real problem. Now, the businesses, warehouses, other businesses are supposed to be engaging in safe practices, not having people in close proximity to each other, wearing face masks 6 feet away, and so forth. The federal government and local governments, but the feds, are supposed to be enforcing that. If some of these places are dangerous because they're not doing it properly, then we ought to, number one, enforce that. And number two, we ought to make sure that the law does not allow refusal to go to work in an unsafe place to be construed as quitting and therefore forfeiting unemployment. And I'm glad he raised that. I'll make sure that that is raised in the negotiations on the next bill, which, as I said, we hope to do in the next week or two.
Couple of things briefly before you go. The New York Times editorial board this weekend called for the Democratic National Committee, not the Trump administration, just the Democratic Party, to appoint a credible panel to investigate the allegations by Tara Reid against Joe Biden. Would you like to either endorse or reject that idea?
Well, let me just say that allegations of sexual assault are always important and must always be taken seriously, and that's what the Vice President, former Vice President Biden, and the party have done. And I think that Mr. Biden should continue to make his records open and available wherever possible and answer questions about these allegations, and the public can decide. Someone observed on one of the TV shows that if the Democratic National Committee were to hold an investigation of its nominee, that would not have a particular credibility. But I think that what I said goes, that I want to commend Biden for making all his records available and answering the questions, and he's going to have to continue doing that, and the public will decide.
For you as chairman of the Judiciary Committee, any thoughts on the Supreme Court starting to hear oral arguments by phone today to maintain social distancing? They're not convening in person, but not even by Zoom, just telephone, taking the term oral arguments very literally, I guess. But does that require any kinds of oversight by you all on the Judiciary Committee?
No, I think it's a good thing that the Supreme Court is doing that. I've introduced legislation in the past to require the Supreme Court and other appellate courts to allow cameras in the courtroom. I think that all their hearings and public hearings, not their private deliberations, ought to be public, and they ought to be public in real time, and I think this is a good thing.
This will be public in a new way for people who don't already know, because the media will be able to listen in live on the phone and use sound bites on the same day. At least audio
sound bites. I think that should have been the case even without the coronavirus. But it's good that it's happening now. And not because of the virus, but it's good the court is doing that.
And so last thing, impeachment and the blackmail of Ukraine seem like such quaint problems in a way, just like every other problem we used to have that wasn't a matter of immediate life or death of thousands of people. Obviously, you had a major role in the impeachment as chairman of the Judiciary Committee. How much does it feel like an almost quaint problem to you, or how much do you think that it does inform or should inform in any way the way we deal with President Trump on coronavirus?
Well, the president has shown in all those issues, the Ukraine, et cetera, and in dealing with the coronavirus, he's shown that he's not trustworthy, that he doesn't tell the truth, he lies all the time, and we have to bear that in mind. Even on the coronavirus, we now know that the president was informed of the threat at the beginning of January in his daily intelligence briefing, which apparently he doesn't read or listen to. We now know that he ignored this for close to 2 months while the problem built up in the United States. We now know that one reason it has gotten so far out of hand is because we didn't start taking steps a month or so before we did, because of the president's ignorance and because of his refusal to deal with this. Just more evidence of his general incompetence, and that all he cares about is himself and his reelection, and not about protecting the people.
He says he was distracted by having to deal with impeachment.
Well, that is nonsense, because a president is, you know, supposed to be able to deal with his problems and whatever they are, and to deal with the issues facing the country. That's his job. And the fact that he refused to read the daily intelligence briefings, the fact that he ignored what he was being told, the fact that he didn't want to hear it, has nothing to do with impeachment.
Gerald Nadler, Democratic Congressman from Brooklyn and Queens, Chairman of the Judiciary Committee. We always appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thank you.